scored less on the post-test compared to the pre-test, and about seven or eight that scored the same, everyone scored higher. And you can see the averages here, under five on the pre-test, and then seven on the post-test. Now, also consider that it was actually two different sets of questions. So same topics, same subjects, but the post-test, it was actually 10 different questions, and they still were able to score considerably higher. So I took that to mean that we were going in the right direction with these groups. To kind of follow up on that, I asked them what their comfort level was for answering indoor questions after they've taken home insect control. And most did actually answer that they were much more comfortable in answering these questions. A pretty similar number said it's still challenging, but they did feel a little bit more at ease at doing it. And some people put little footnotes that it was somewhat conditional. For example, they'd feel very comfortable doing stored product insects, but maybe ants they were still a little, you know, a little iffy on. One person said it didn't make any difference. One person actually said it's harder now. And their explanation for this was before they didn't really take all that much time in identifying things, and now that they knew what was all involved, you know, an ant isn't an ant or a fly isn't a fly, they said, wow, it's harder now. But she quickly said, but that's a good thing. So I was actually interested in the comments by Mike and Carlos about where they taught that, because obviously Minnesota is not as big, but there is a travel issue. And the first several that I taught of this class were on the St. Paul campus. So you can see down there, kind of south central Minnesota or southeast Minnesota. And that was an easy decision to make. That's where I work. Had easy access to lab facilities, dissecting microscopes. Half of the master gardeners live in that area. And, you know, so it was pretty easy to attract people to take this class. But at the same time, I did want to, you know, get out to other parts of the state and teach this. But I wasn't sure how to do that because there was a fair amount of time involved. You know, I could not drive out to, you know, some of these places and do this as evening classes. There was the issues with the labs and dissecting microscopes. And then kind of one day in an epiphany, I suppose, I realized that master gardeners, when they take the initial core course, they will, you know, although they're doing evening classes, you know, 3 hours, they also do 6 hours weekday, 6 hours weekend. So I thought, well, if I trim these 15 hours, perhaps down to 12 hours, and if I could get counties to host this, and especially if I could get them to be responsible for lab and dissecting microscopes, that would make it easier, because I was kind of reluctant to be traveling like 10 or 12 dissecting microscopes. That didn't seem practical. And so I did that. I kind of advertised this, and if you think master gardeners in the metro area where they are more accustomed to getting programs, you know, like this, they're even more starved out in greater Minnesota for these programs, and they sometimes think we are forgetting about them. Because, as I said, you know, half of the population of the state is actually, you know, right there, or maybe over half. So I did this, and just, you know, I won't maybe name names here specifically, but I did, in a series of programs, get to southwest Minnesota, northern Minnesota, eastern Minnesota, northwest Minnesota, central Minnesota, and then actually to kind of change things up, because some master gardeners would kind of grumble about being in the eastern part of the metro, then I actually taught a core course in the western part of this of our Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. So currently we have 31 counties that are represented. Again, a kind of a goal of mine was to get these people as distributed as much as possible. That's about a third of the counties, and about 121 master gardeners are currently in the program. More have been taught, some have dropped out, or there have been other reasons why they're not currently in it. Now, you know, this is kind of the initial, what I call core course for this, but this was always meant as an ongoing program. So the idea was they wouldn't take it and that was it, because, you know, anytime you get education like that, if you don't keep getting it reinforced, you're going to forget about it. So how did I go about doing this? Well, I started off with some regular email communications with them, kind of give them little updates about what to expect, you know, for a certain period of time. But then really what was, I think, even more important was the home insect control update programs, what we affectionately call HICCUP. And this has kind of been different, you know, from year to year. It's never taught quite exactly the same, but generally one in the spring, One in the fall, generally on campus, although I have taught it now at the state conference, which rotates in different parts of the state. We'll talk about the website in a few more slides. And, you know, again, this has kind of evolved as to what we do, but I try to focus on one particular insect, give them, you know, kind of additional information that maybe we didn't get in core course, or new information that, you know, I've maybe learned at ESA or other things. And then we'll follow that up with a series of exercises that we call pest scenarios. And these are literally things that have come to me in emails, phone calls, things that people mail to me. I give it right back to them exactly in the same form that I got. So here's the beginning of an email. Usually this is followed up with images, is actually the image that I received of the pest scenario that we just started with. Or maybe I have to take the picture. I'll give this to them a few days ahead of time because some like to study it and be kind of prepped for it. But then we'll go through it and we'll ask them four basic questions. What is it? Where did it come from? What is it doing? You know, what kind of damage? And then what do you do about it? And you know, these are things that, because I see it, they could see it, and it helps reinforce things that we learned. Some of it may be things we didn't talk about, so it's an opportunity to learn new topics. And then kind of what I think is the most fun is we do Insect Jeopardy. This is a template that I got at one of our extension in-service days, and it's just like the game you'd see on TV. I write up the questions and the answers, and each category, you know, the questions are all in theory related. You can, I think, probably guess most of these. Sleep tight is bed bugs. Broadcast news is articles I've written for our newsletter, just to see if you're actually reading what I write. Oktoberfest is fall invading insects. Fly away is flies. And then my house is a potpourri of questions, things that I actually found in my house. And it's fun. They're learning at the same time, and I think they enjoy it. And you know, these updates are meant to, you know, be fun and enjoyable. And then you know, it also eventually I developed this website, kind of a clearinghouse of information, so they could go to it. It is still kind of a work in progress. It's actually, most of this is public. I'll show you a URL here in a second, and you know, you can get to most of these links. But you will see over here on the side. Get the pointer to work. You can see that this section here is for master gardeners who have taken this class only. And this is a place where I can put the updates, especially like the pest scenarios and you know, the insect updates. So if you didn't take the class, or you did and you just wanted to see it again, you know, that's situated there. And then we're trying to develop some PowerPoint presentations, because some like to go out and teach. And instead of me just giving what I use, I think it's easier to kind of, you know, kind of synthesize it down and give it to them. So this is the URL, and if you want to get into the area that's on the right, that's the username and the password. I'll give you a second or two to write that down. Okay. If you don't get all that, you can ask me at the break. So then, how do master gardeners use this information? And actually, in a lot of different ways. You know, I assume primarily it was from phone calls, and that is where most of the master gardeners will use this. Also, they'll be answering emails. I was a little surprised by the number that will do household insect questions at state fairs, county fairs, that not only answer questions, but actually make displays. I mean, they're very proactive, you know, really get into it. It can make some very elaborate stuff to show people. Some are motivated enough to actually teach classes, they'll write articles. In the other category, things like farmers markets, teaching other master gardeners in their counties, which is good. Friends and family, just for their own personal use. And very fortunately, nobody put that they did not use it in any way at all. I was rather glad to see that. So with that, I think I have a little time for questions.
And methoxyphenazide. So that basically now means that growers in at least the southern interior of British Columbia are restricted to using two types of treatments, and they're basically restricted to BT products and spinosyn-based products. So this really means that growers need new options, and we need to go beyond perhaps just some of the traditional things that we were using. So this brings up the potential of using essential oils, which we've been working with in our lab. Now, essential oils have been demonstrated as insecticidal agents, and one of the benefits is that they are NOP and OMRI approved. And actually, just to show an example, we have, let's see if we can get this to work. Okay, we have these oils here, or these products here are actually essential oil-based products that are produced by a company here in the States called EcoSmart Technologies. And they're actually, I know that they're actually in use here in California. So this is just an example, and just going to see what we can get for our two pests. So the objectives of my research are to find essential oils that are toxic against the leaf roller and the rosy apple aphid. Another area that we're kind of addressing is what is the mode of action of these oils, and how are these insects breaking down these oils? What are the detoxification mechanisms? And the reason why this is important is because this suggests potential roles. If we can understand the detoxification mechanisms, we can understand what type of synergists we might be able to use to make these oils more effective. For the course of this talk, I'm going to be addressing mainly the first objective. And then my future research is going to be looking more into the second objective. So what we did is we used neonate leaf roller larvae, and we used adult rosy apple aphids. In the field, these are typically the two stages that we are aiming to control. And then we used a huge list of essential oils, and I actually used 21 oils, and you'll notice we've also got sesame oil, soybean oil, sunflower oil, and cottonseed oil, so these are actually carrier oils. But we thought, well, let's just try these out and see, because a lot of the times carrier oils are used to dilute essential oils. The other thing you'll notice is that the most represented plant family here is the Lamiaceae. We've got marjoram, peppermint, patchouli oil, pennyroyal oil, rosemary oil. So this is one of the biggest plant families that's used for developing essential oils. What I did was we prepared emulsions of these essential oils using Tween 80 as an emulsifier, and you can see it did a pretty decent job of creating a nice emulsion. And then we took these oils and we sprayed them on the insects, and of course this is going, now it's being nice, come on, okay, there we go. Alright, apparently we're not using the mouse. We took the essential oils and onto the insects, and we placed the insects first onto filter paper inside of glass petri dishes. And then once the oils had been sprayed on the insects, we transferred the insects to clean either leaf discs in the case of rosy apple aphid, and we were using the secondary plant host for the rosy apple aphid, so those are plantain leaf discs. Or in the case of the oblique banded leaf roller, we put them with artificial diet. And then 24 hours later, we assessed mortality, and in the case of two of the oils, we also used probate analysis to determine the LC50 values. What we observed was, when it came to the leaf rollers, not much was very effective. These are the top six essential oils, but we did find that patchouli oil was great. And these were applied at a concentration of 0.5%. The next highest oil was the white thyme oil. What we noticed with the thyme oil, though, is that it actually took about 48 hours to get this level of mortality. We only had 38% mortality at 24 hours, so, and this is 56% mortality. And this is going to be important in the next slide, because here we use the synergist piperonal butoxide, which is a cytochrome P450 inhibitor, and we use that at 1/10 the rate. You'll notice mortality in the control was very low, but the big thing that happened is that when it came to thyme oil, we noticed that the rate of kill was much faster. We actually observed the same level of results within 24 hours that it took 48 hours to get without PBO. So this suggests a role of, this does suggest a synergistic reaction for thyme oil. And if you look at cedarwood and clove bud oil, it really does appear that there is a synergistic action going on here. So this does seem to indicate that the cytochrome P450s are involved. And as I said, we calculated the LC50 values for two of the oils. The interesting thing here to note is that patchouli oil was 4.25 times more effective than thyme oil. So I think right now it's looking like patchouli oil is probably the way to go. When it came to the roseapple aphids, we actually had quite interesting results. If you remember on the leaf rollers, we only had two of the oils made it above 50% mortality at this concentration. With a roseapple aphid, we had 14 out of the 21 oils were effective, and 10 of these were essential oils. These are the top six. Again, the thing to note is patchouli oil was the most effective, but unlike with the leaf rollers, thyme oil didn't even make this list, and that was actually quite ineffective against the aphids. The other interesting thing that we found was that the carrier oils were actually really effective. And a lot of the times people say carrier oils are inert. Well, this shows that carrier oils are not always inert. Now, don't know what the mode of action is here. It's going to be interesting to potentially figure out what that is. Of course, sesame does contain sesamin, and that it has been shown to be insecticidal, but we'll have to see. The other ones, maybe it's through suffocation, perhaps through other methods. So, in summary, basically what we found is that patchouli and white thyme oil are the most toxic of the oils against the oblique blended leaf roller. The other thing that we noticed is that the addition of PBO did increase mortality for most of the oils. So this does suggest a role for cytochrome P450s involved in detoxification. And it also allows us to maybe think of, okay, well, maybe we can use PBO analogs as potential synergists. So examples include isosafrol or so on and so forth. So, you know, this gives us a few different options. And the other trend that we noticed was that these essential oils are much more effective against the roseapple aphid. Again, patchouli was the most effective. The carrier oils were highly toxic. So it's going to be interesting to see what we can do with this at the next stage. And for the next stage, what we really need to do before we can go anywhere with using these oils at a field level is we really need to look further into what synergistic combinations we can come up with and how we can optimize the formulas. We used Tween 80 this time around, but of course, as many of you know, different emulsifiers give a lot better results. So formulation optimization is the next step. And then, as I said, we want to look at what the mode of action is and how we can detoxify these, or how these insects are detoxifying these oils, because that'll help us to understand what oils maybe we can use and how to make the oils more effective. And with that, I'd just like to acknowledge the funding sources, NSERC, EcoSafe Natural Products, EcoSmart Technologies, and the Pesticide Risk Reduction and Minor Use Research Program at the Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada.
So you mentioned your methodology, you're directly spraying first in source. So a two-part question. Have you looked at the effects of spraying larger insects, and also have you looked at the effect of spraying the leaf
To this point, we haven't. So the question was if we've tried spraying larger insects and also if we've tried applying it to the leaf discs and then putting the insects on. To this point, we haven't. Generally, with the leaf roller, the stage that you want to target is the neonates, because after that, they tend to wrap themselves up in the leaves. So we've been working with the neonates to date. But we do need to look at the other stages as well. So I actually will be doing some more work with the later instars later. The next step as well is also what is the residual toxicity. So applying it to the leaf discs and then putting the insects on that. Yep.
PBO and the roseapple aphid, I didn't see that. Where do you
we didn't do that this time.
Phytotoxicity on the leaves, if you're thinking about
them. Yes. Phytotoxicity has been noted for a lot of oils. I actually used a clove oil-based product before as a apple blossom thinner, so that definitely you do get phytotoxicity, but we're hoping that at this point, with 0.5%, we won't, but before, obviously, before any product development, we have to do that.